Righto, Money Miners, here we go. Brian Lax from the Old West. But, oh, God, mate, how good's the bloody US at the moment? Jeez. We're going to have to move over soon, Brian. Save us the bloody getting up early.
Thanks for...
It's almost 5 o'clock here, so we're 4 o'clock. We're doing just fine.
Where are you? East, west? Where are you situated?
I'm in Los Angeles, so on the west coast here. So glad we were able to figure out a time zone.
God's country, mate.
Brian, we are very thankful you've made the time for us. You know, one of these funds we sort of come across, hadn't heard about before we'd started the show, in all honesty, and then we dig into it and you're talking about, or you're writing about in your quarterly letters, everything we love to chat about. We've got tin, we've got copper. What else have we got, Maddie? There was bits of lithium and some chats I've heard you speak about.
Good old uranium.
Uranium, mate. How could we forget? There was a bit of silver, a bit of gold mentioned, and it's really interesting because you're not a mining-specific fund, but you're sort of very value-oriented and you found your way in there. So I'm very excited to get into it. Maddie, where should we start? I think uranium's one of the ones you're most excited about.
Mate, we're so much the wiser after interviewing Mike Alkin the other week. I wish I could bloody do it again. Are you mates with Mike? Have you been around the traps with him?
We've talked before. I've met him before. I was telling you guys earlier, I got a little chuckle listening to that interview because he definitely goes deep at times, and it's not for the faint of heart if it's your first time listening to that sort of thing.
Oh, mate, there was a lot of Googling going on that weekend from my end. Got a bit of a bloody better understanding. What is your sort of, how much attention is going towards uranium from your end at the moment, and probably more so, when did it start for you?
Yeah, we've been in uranium a very long time now, I guess going on 6-7 years. It was actually one of the first things that I started looking at when I joined Old West back in 2016. It was still pretty early into the trade there, kind of depths of the bear market. I think the uranium price bottomed that year around $18. And so there wasn't a lot of people looking at it. There were a few, I guess, farsighted people who thought maybe there was some reason to believe that things would change in the future, which we did. And we started to do a lot of work 2016, 2017, started to build some positions. And then 2018, we actually launched a fund to really focus there, just because, our most of our funds are pretty diversified. And so having a large concentration into something like uranium when you're at the bottom of the market and a lot of these stocks were basically micro caps, it really made sense to have a separate vehicle to do those types of investments. And so that's actually the fund that I manage today.
So working, the big thing we took out of the chat with Mike was how the modeling works for this, working backwards from the amount of reactors that are due to come online, then the enrichment capacity into that, then the supply drive and the tail that's going to come out of those, be used in that enrichment facility. Do you do much modelling on that sort of real macro scale of uranium, or are you more focused on sort of what equities are most exposed to it? What's your sort of thesis?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, I think you have to, if you're going to look at the sector, you have to get familiar with what the supply and demand is. So, what mines are producing what or can produce, looking at that whole supply stack, the cost curve. And then from the demand side, where do you see it going? I think at the time, our view was that the supply had just been completely destroyed after whatever that was, 5 years of a bear market. And so really, it was a supply-driven thesis that if you believe that demand was not dead, which I think a lot of people did, they thought nuclear power was over. But if you had a view that it was still going and that they were building reactors and that the reactors that were here were going to be kept alive, it was pretty evident that there was not going to be enough supply to meet that demand. And the price was too low to give an incentive for new mines. And that's actually really a common recipe that we see in some of the places that we invest in, is that, there's a shortage of something, and in order for there to be more supply brought online, you're going to need higher prices for those projects to make sense. And so, at the time, it was a lot of looking at development projects. There weren't a lot of producers out there. I mean, Cameco was the big one, because Kazatomprom didn't come public until I think, late 2018 timeframe. So really it was, you want to buy Cameco, or, you know, there's a bunch of uranium projects that don't make sense at $20 or $25. But we had the view that, hey, the price needs to go up dramatically in order for these projects to be brought on, because I think we will need these projects. And so you could really, if you had the view that it was going to, say, you know, north of 50 or 60, and you could run that through these mine plans, a lot of them were trading at 10 or 20 cents on the dollar. And so, you know, coming out of 2019, 2020, I mean, we were probably a top 10 shareholder in a lot of the household uranium names. You know, and still own a bunch to this day. I think today it's a little bit different of an analysis because the price has adjusted. It's gone from 20 to 100, you know, pulled back a little bit. It's around 90, I think, right now. So a lot of those projects that we were looking at, you know, now they actually have the right price environment to be developed. And now it's just a matter of timing, you know, like we wrote about in our letter that we just released. Just because the price gets to a place where you can start building projects doesn't mean your shortage is fixed overnight. Now, you know, how long is it going to take to build and all of that sort of thing? Are they permitted? Are they under construction? And so really, I think looking at it today, it's not so much that we need a much higher price. Well, we probably still do. I think, you know, that was a good conversation you had with Mike last week, that even if you bring on a lot of these mines, it still doesn't solve the deficit. And so really the question today is, how high does it go? And then does it, you know, is it a spike and then comes back, or is it more of a gradual rise? And I think, you know, when you start looking at those questions, the type of investments that it leads you to differs from what it did, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when we were really heavy in the space.
Brian, you had a funny quote in a podcast I listened to that you'd done about half a year ago, and describing what you just said there, and you called Cameco your sort of gateway drug into the world of uranium. That was I thought that was quite funny. I want to tie this in with your investment style, because you're very value oriented, you know, Buffett Munger style, Ben Graham style of investing. How do you see the balance, as you know, the thesis has sort of played out, not completely played out, but to an extent has played out, and you need to start looking at value in some of these names, some of the uranium miners or developers just were expensive by a lot of measures late last year, and things have changed as the price sort of floats around. But where we're sitting today, how do you see value across the spectrum, perhaps looking at Sprott and the physical trust versus some of the miners, be it producers, developers, explorers?
Yeah, I think it's a different sort of analysis. I mean, I guess it's similar analysis, but there's a different starting point. You know, the valuations of a lot of these names are much different than they were 4 or 5 years ago. A lot of the stocks have gone up fivefold or tenfold or more. And so I think back then you could really just kind of close your eyes and throw a dart at the space and you'd probably do well over a few year period. Now I think there's probably more opportunities for, you know, where relative value is more important. I think there's some stocks that are probably overpriced or are baking in, you know, a really high uranium price. There are probably some that are more fairly valued. But it's not, and I guess I would add to that, you know, the physical price, you know, owning something like Sprott or physical uranium actually probably makes a lot more sense now, especially if you believe that there's going to be a spike in the price because of this timing lag that maybe doesn't get captured by guys that are going to, you know, bring on projects 5 years from now. So it's a different way of looking at things. You have a different starting valuation. And I think if you look at our portfolio and you know, we have to file, we're big enough where we file a 13F. So most of the US names that we own, you can see in our filings, you can see that the number of names we've owned has shrunk dramatically. I mean, we've really concentrated around what we think are the highest quality ones. And I think probably more so have looked to kind of recoil that spring by looking for other areas that have that same sort of fundamental setup, but where the price hasn't yet inflected to that point where, you know, now, hey, if you want to bring on a mine, you can. And it's just a matter of, are there enough? And then how long does it take? So, you know, I think probably to sum it up, that it's there's still, I think, plenty of upside ahead. A lot of the stocks have started to price that in, some more so than others. And I think one of the interesting things to look at is, you know, which stocks are well above the highs that they made in, you know, call it mid to late 2021, because some of them are still below that. And I think you've seen that bifurcation in quality and valuation start to play out. And it's a lot more important to do that sort of work than it was kind of in the early days when a rising tide really lifted all the boats.
And just across the board with your Invanium investment, your uranium investment.
Invanium, I didn't know. What bloody, is this a finance word? I didn't know.
So excited, I'm stumbling to get the words out. Across the board on your uranium investment, how do you think about that position as a whole, given the correlation is quite high amongst a lot of these names in terms of positioning it in your portfolio? How have you gone about that over the past 3 or 4 years that you've been looking at it?
Yeah, like I said, it's gotten more concentrated. We've become more selective, more discerning. We probably only have a handful of names now, whereas, 4 years ago at the bottom of COVID, we maybe had 25 names. Really took more of a basket approach at the outset, just because there weren't a lot of ways to get exposure to it. I mean, if you remember at the time, this was probably early to mid 2018, there was really only one ETF out there. It was the URA, and they changed their index basically at the bottom of the market because the stocks got too illiquid. And so they added half of the portfolio as, kind of nuclear adjacent companies, but there was a lot of irrelevant stuff in there. And so we kind of built our own sort of pseudo ETF in-house of a basket of names, producers, developers, explorers, because we weren't really sure how it was going to play out. We had a very strong view that the price had to rise and pretty significantly, but we weren't really sure. I mean, there's kind of a path dependency on a lot of these names on which is going to outperform. And so we didn't try to be heroes and say, hey, we're just going to pick one name and hope it does the best. And we were actually kind of surprised in hindsight that some of the names that did the best for us were ones we might not have picked if we had to just pick one. Because I think when you get a strongly rising commodity price environment, a lot of times, some of the real small, illiquid, maybe higher cost stuff sees a disproportionate move higher, sort of a dash for trash, they might call it. And so we wanted to own kind of a broad spectrum of names just to encapsulate all of that, where the overall return for that whole portfolio would look superior to just sort of trying to pick one name based on quality or valuation or something like that.
How do you look at SPUT in terms of trading it? If you've still got the positive view on uranium and say, SPUT's trading at a 5% discount to NAV. So do you look at it, right, I still believe in the uranium thesis, I can get a dollar for 95 cents here. Or is it not that simple when trading SPUT?
I think SPUT is good for someone who has a view that they really want to play the spot price because that is what they think will squeeze higher, in the coming years or quarters or whatever their time frame is, versus a miner where, unless it gets sort of traded as like a trading sardine and valued up alongside Horizon, that, the way we think of it is, what is the price they're going to earn over the life of the mine? And that's why I said it really depends. Is your view that the price of uranium is going to spike to 200 or higher over a short period of time and then potentially fall back down or plateau? Or, it really depends on what your view of where uranium prices go and how they go. Because I think if you're, if your view is that because there's, even though the price is here, there's not enough supply coming online and that's going to create a big squeeze, SPUT's probably the way to play that, because that's going to get the purest expression of what that price does. Whereas, these equities are supposed to be sort of discounting machines of what cash flows they could generate. And if it's a big spike and drop, they're not necessarily going to capture that. And so there's an extra layer of that, which is, what are the stocks already pricing in? I think that was one of the reasons we consolidated our portfolio a little bit over the last couple of years was, it seemed like the equities had gotten ahead of themselves versus what the uranium price had done. Remember, the uranium price kind of ran in its initial move to 50 in 2020 and 2021. A lot of the stocks had a real big move over that 2 year period. And then you really had the price of uranium kind of flatline there for about 18 months. It was really pinned at $50. And you saw a lot of the equities kind of digest that move and retrace a bit. And then kind of middle of last year, they started to pick back up as the uranium price started to run again. So, I think, what are the equities pricing in? And JD kind of hinted at it, some of these things are getting pretty frothy in terms of valuation. Or alternatively, you need to believe that the price goes much higher to justify them if you're doing like a traditional valuation methodology, but really I think for Spud, it's probably a good way to play physical. If you're not buying it yourself, and as Mike alluded to, it's difficult. It's not for everybody to set up an account at a converter and try to store physical pounds there. So it is a nice vehicle to exist. But like I said, I think that we're less interested in trying to play kind of a squeeze type scenario with a big part of our capital. I think we liked that. We liked the setup a few years ago when this sort of same fundamental setup existed, but the price was below what anyone's view of marginal cost was. I think we do see that same sort of setup in other commodities, which is why we've really broadened out our portfolio to include some of these other opportunities, especially as the valuations on the uranium side have gotten to kind of more, I don't want to use normalized levels, but they're more reflective of a market that's in deficit than they were, 4 or 5 years ago when they were just being given away. And so if we can still own the ones that we think are going to benefit from increased price movement, which we think is likely, but also kind of, like I said, recoil the spring and find some of these other areas that have a similar shortage scenario, but the price hasn't started to move yet. We've been adding more of that to our portfolio, and it's given us a little bit more balance.
Just to close the uranium one out, mate, in terms of the contracting side of things, and if we're going to sort of head towards a bit more of a spike in the contracting, what is on your radar in terms of probably companies and projects that you're waiting to see what contracts are going to be put in place to give a feel of what this floor and ceiling arrangement's going to be going forward?
Well, I think everyone watches Cameco because they're really the most transparent in an industry where a lot of these things are confidential. They're not disclosed. They're just bilateral agreements. But usually on their quarterly conference calls, they'll give an update of the contracting market. I think a lot of people are waiting to see what NextGen does. Obviously, it's a huge mine, people are wondering how that material is going to get pieced into the market, because it would be a very big chunk of world production when it comes on, and how does it get phased and all of that. So, I mean, those are a couple of names that we'd be watching for. And then just, kind of more general news on the different players, kind of more bit players that are getting contracts signed. What's the chatter coming out of that? Like I said, I still think that there's a lot of upside ahead. It's really now, though, these things dislocate from the fundamentals on the way down. I think that's where they were kind of through the late teens when they there was no reason for the uranium price to trade so low for so long. There were kind of a few unique quirks to the industry that allowed that can to get kicked for a while. I think the uranium price can dislocate from fundamentals to the upside as well. I think we're kind of already getting to that point because, here we are at $90, and it's not like there's a wave of supply coming on tomorrow. They still have to build these things. And like Mike alluded to last week, there's, even if you give every, bring all these things on, you're probably still short over the next 5-6 years. So it'll be an interesting time, but how high it goes, I don't know. That's something that's kind of out of my wheelhouse. I much prefer looking at things where I know that, hey, if the price of something is below the marginal cost and we need more, I mean, the price is going to have to rise. And I think you see that in some of these other places. And so, we still own what we view as kind of a high quality basket of uranium names that should benefit if the price continues to rise like we think it has to. I mean, the market's not going to get balanced anytime soon, but it's a much easier thesis for me to say, hey, I'm looking at XYZ commodity, it's in shortage, and no one's going to bring on a project unless the price goes up a bunch. A lot of these things that we look at are pretty niche. The valuations are quite low because I don't think there's a lot of attention on them. And so we're happy to really start building positions in these areas ahead of, when the price starts to move and when the crowd really starts to jump on these things.
Very good. Thanks, mate. Love it.
Brian, I want to talk about tin now. And the way I want to go about this to start is to learn how you discovered tin, because, in your investment style, you say you're not top down, and, going bottom up in tin, we're really talking about Metals X and Alpha Min. Is that the way in which you discovered, the market setup in tin, and then you learn about it more broadly, or was tin a bit different? How did it all come about to start with?
Yeah, tin, I guess it first came on our radar probably probably early 2020 was Alphamin had just brought on their mine a few months earlier, and you know there were some guys talking about it. You know, it actually Alphamin was the first way we heard about it. You know, the stock had done really well. Excuse me, the first I guess few months of 2020, it was up like 60% or something. And so you saw guys talking about it, and then COVID hit and it got cut in half. And it was one of those things where I was like, oh man, you know, glad we dodged that bullet. And then kind of forgot about it for a while, and then, you know, re-picked it up maybe later in 2020 when we saw that it had doubled kind of back to that same level it had been before. You know, and it was one of these things where the thesis made sense. You know, it was a very similar type of story of, hey, there's a shortage here and the price is too low. We're going to need more supply. We're going to, you know, it's kind of the same thing. But at the time, you know, we were so focused on uranium, it was just, you know, almost one of these, you know, curiosities, but then we, you know, kind of did a little bit of work on it and put it to the side. You know, I think we didn't really get involved until kind of early 2021, mid 2021. You know, and at that time it was playing out in a strong way. You had a big demand pull forward from COVID, everyone buying, you know, new laptops and computers and stuff. You had some supply chain snarls happening that really caused a bit of a squeeze. excuse me, to, you know, the price got to like, I want to say maybe 50,000 a ton in early 22. So you got a glimpse of how tight the market was and, you know, fragile that supply demand balance was. You know, but like I said, for most of those years, we were pretty heavily invested in uranium. And so that was our main focus. You know, throughout 2022, obviously in the middle of 2022, the price peaked out. You had a couple of things happen. The Fed started raising interest rates and China shut down their economy for COVID zero. And so a lot of commodities got whacked, tin especially. So, you know, it's a pretty small market. It's very volatile. You had some traders and speculators jumping on it and pounding it down. And so you saw the price drop, I think it was 60%, like 6 months. And so for us who, you know, an ideal situation for us is to find something that has a good long-term setup, but then poor short-term either sentiment or dynamics, right? Because that allows you to really build positions and things when people hate them. Even though you have a view that maybe a few years out, things are going to look a lot different. And we have the benefit of, you know, an investor base that knows that that's our style of long-term investing and kind of zigging when the market's zagging. And if we can find something that has that compelling fundamental setup and do the work and build the positions when no one's looking at it or the market's weak for some reason, that's ideal for us. And so throughout 2022, as the market was crashing, we're like, hey, this is great. I mean, we were, you know, I had just really started ramping up, doing a lot of work on it. So we dialed up a lot of the positions throughout 2022. You know, the market bottomed there, I think, in late 22, and then started to improve throughout 2023. And really, it was over those 2 years that we built our positions. You know, it's for what we were kind of viewing as an eventuality of, hey, people, you know, during a rate hike cycle and, you know, China worries, everyone's just focused on the demand side of things and just selling every commodity. No one wants to touch it. How low are these things going to go? How high are rates going to go? You know, it was this whole conversation focused on the demand side and no one wanted to touch anything. No one cared about all these supply problems that were on the horizon, which is really what got us interested in it, is the supply situation was just a complete mess. And so we're like, look, at some point, this is going to start to bite here, even if the you know, general investment community doesn't want to touch commodities here because, you know, they're afraid of how high rates might go. So anyways, that's our ideal scenario. And we were buying a lot of this stuff the last couple of years. And, you know, sure enough, you fast forward to, I guess, earlier this year, and all of a sudden people start focusing on the supply side of the commodity problems. And you start to see a little bit of strength in the prices. You know, I think it just kind of shows that, well, one, you need the right type of investor base that is willing to, you know, ride with you while you're building those positions and things are going against you. But, you know, as we saw with uranium, you know, I mean, I guess if I draw a parallel there in 2018 and 2019, when we were building our uranium positions, I mean, the stocks were languishing. I mean, they were terrible investments. But because of the way we, you know, design and we, you know, raise over time and we build positions over time, it actually worked to our benefit to have a short-term period of negative performance, because we can continually build these positions at lower and lower costs, so that when eventually these long-term fundamentals start to shine through, we already have, you know, full position sizing and we're off to the races.
Is tin, like, what other commodity can you compare it to in terms of the amount of pure play investments in there? Like you said, Alpha Metals X, like, is it similar to like a niobium, like where you got just bugger all plays to get a pure exposure to it?
You know, I think niobium maybe is a little bit more concentrated. You know, they got the one guy producing, you know, 80 or 90% of the market. But for tin, yeah, there's not a lot of ways to play it. That's actually something we really like about it. Uranium, we used to think was that way. I mean, when we were first looking at the sector, there were maybe only 15 or 20 names of, you know, of any sort of merit, and maybe a fewer portion of that was were things that actually could be invested in. And we thought that was great, right? Because you look at something like gold or even copper, and there's hundreds of ways to play it. And so it's kind of a maze to dig through all that. You know, looking at uranium, where there were only a dozen names or so, was actually refreshing. Tin, I mean, it's, you know, yeah, like you said, there's only really a handful of names there that you can invest in that are big enough, that are meaningful, that aren't just kind of low quality promotional projects. And so it we like that because, you know, we can build positions there. And if we're right about the thesis and we're right that the flows need to come in, you know, they get pretty concentrated into only a few names. It's not like, you know, gold, people decide they want to own gold miners, and it's like you got a list, you know, 500 companies long of which ones they can pick. I mean, if you start to do the math on tin, you say, hey, I think there's something here. There aren't a lot of ways to express that view. And so I think that works to our benefit, where if we can identify these things ahead of a lot of the investment community doing that work, then we can build positions at a pretty low cost and really let the market come to us. You know, so we can have a pretty heavy weight in something before people start to look at it, and then, you know, kind of lighten it up to a more normal weighting, you know, as the thesis plays out and these things go from extremely cheap to very cheap.
Heaps less shit to read. That'd be the best thing about it, wouldn't it?
That's right. Well, look, I think, especially with something like uranium, there's a huge learning curve there. As you guys got a nice dose of last week when you were talking to Mike, it's a very complex industry. And so you don't want to have to scramble and start all of your research once the things are already moving and everybody's piling in. We love having a nice year or two to really dive into something, get to understand it well when no one's talking about it, no one's doing anything, the equities are trading for nothing. That's just a perfect scenario. And I think we saw that in tin the last couple of years when, you know, the tin price was in the $20,000 range. Nobody's making money. You know, half the industry is hurting. But that's a great time to be, you know, building models and looking at where the supply is going to come from and what's demand doing and all that sort of work that takes time to really do it well. It's nice to be able to do it when the stocks are still being given away and not a lot of other people are talking about it. I mean, look, there's a handful of people that are talking about it. Like I told JD earlier, I mean, that's one of the reasons, you know, I'm a big fan of this show. You guys actually talk about some of that stuff. There's not a lot of ways to find information on the sector. I think that's, you know, a good thing and a bad thing, right? I mean, everyone wants to be a contrarian and take some view that something's going to be very different a few years from now. But eventually the market has to agree with you because that's how you get paid. Otherwise, these things just sort of languish at very low multiples. You know, you want to be a contrarian and identify the momentum before it comes momentum. But if these things just stay unknown or stay low value, I mean, you're not going to really get paid on your money. I think there's a lot of value traps out there that people find themselves in that never really get that re-rating. But yeah, it's nice not having to, you know, analyze 100 companies. I mean, it's pretty, you can look at the sector and pretty quickly see who's real and who's not. It's that doesn't take a lot of time. I guess what takes time is to really understand the supply and demand and say, hey, is this actually going to work like we think it is? Because if it does, and you know, we like these situations where it doesn't actually have to work in a big way for you to do very well. And I think you can that's why I like investing in these things when the price of the commodity is below that marginal cost, because you think that's at least a floor that it has to get to. And then the fact that these companies are trading at like, you know, 2x or 3x, that's easy for us. Let's just kind of sit here and wait. You don't want to wait forever. There's a bit of a timing component here. But I think if you can identify something that has that sort of upside, you can still wait a few years and your annual return is going to be very good. And so, you know, it's worked for us and we've been able to build a portfolio around it. And I think if you can kind of stagger these different sorts of opportunities at different time intervals, you can really keep it evergreen and not, you know, not just be having to wait for one thing to work for your whole portfolio to work.
In your research there, getting deep into tin, I'm sure you would have come across the dynamic that played out with Myanmar and the setup a decade or so ago. You know, wasn't too dissimilar from what it is now. And Myanmar came a bit from left field. Obviously, there's a few other things going on. But how do you think about these risks from left field, potential countries, potential sources of supply that could just come out and change the game, really?
Yeah, well, I think we saw that in nickel, really, and with the Indonesians, you know, over the last couple of years. In Myanmar, for tin, yeah, I mean, they basically came out of nowhere and became the third largest producer. But then it went away just as quickly as it came, because it was, I think it was an artisanal mine and they realized there was a lot of tin there. And so they did a little bit more heavy lifting, were able to really produce a bunch, but then kind of hit a wall and said, hey, if we're going to continue to do this, you know, we need to really bring in some serious capital and some more kind of industrial mining methods. And, you know, I think that was a big problem because that wasn't the way they had done it before. And so, you know, it's also in a kind of a wild part of the world there. It's in that breakaway region of the country. You know, they had a coup there a few years ago. China's heavily involved. It's right on the border. You know, it just is it's a pretty crazy thing to think about that was, you know, 10 or 15% of the world's tin or more. I guess that's what it is now. You know, and so it looked like there was a bit of maybe a cash grab there. You know, they shut down that mine last year. You know, there was a lot of talk about it earlier in the year last year than they officially did it, I think, in August. And, you know, it was hard to get news out of there. I mean, it's really hard to find Myanmar news. But, you know, I think that the government or whatever their ruling party is of that breakaway region, you know, said, okay, you can turn back these mines on, but you know, we want 30% of the tin. I mean, there was kind of a, you know, it wasn't a perfect solution. I mean, you know, I guess it wasn't as bad for Myanmar. Well, maybe it was, but it was kind of worse for the Chinese, who were reliant on that concentrate to feed their smelters. You know, they're kind of half the market. So, you know, yeah, thinking about how those things can come on. I mean, it wasn't overnight. I mean, it ramped from, you know, maybe 2012 to 2017. So it was kind of this 5-year story. But like I said, it went away just as fast. And we're, I guess, mindful that you can find new sources of supply, but there's just not a lot of people looking for it right now. And I think that's the really interesting thing about looking at some of these commodities where the price is temporarily low for some reason, is there's not an incentive to go spend a lot of money looking for this stuff. If the tin price starts to rise, yeah, maybe you'll see some exploration dollars flow, but then there's no guarantee that comes on either. And, you know, then those things have to be built. And you're kind of like where uranium is okay, now the price is high. Who's going to build the stuff that's already out there? And then what else is there that we can build? You know, and how much higher does these prices have to go to really smoke out enough supply to balance the market? So I'm less worried about another Myanmar coming out of nowhere with some unforeseen supply than I am just about, you know, really the thing that's weighed on tin in the past has been the demand side, you know, and what's happening there. I think we really had a bit of a hangover from that COVID demand pull forward in 2022 and 2023, but you're starting to see, you know, semi demand pick back up. And if that's the case, then people are going to focus on supply. And I don't see supply coming anywhere close to meeting demand. We're going to need a lot of projects, and a lot of them are, you know, need a much higher price to be developed. And so, you know, in the ideal world, the price goes up to let some of these marginal projects in, or at least get to that level. And then the guys that can produce or can do it at a little bit lower cost are going to earn those extra margins over a longer period of time than you would expect. I think that's the way we see things playing out. And it's surprising to us that you can buy these things at pretty cheap valuations today, if that's how it does play out.
Who's your preferred pick out of Alphamin and Metals X?
Oh, man, you're going to get a lot of people angry at me.
Cause a fight on Twitter.
It goes back and forth. You know, I can see why a lot of people like Alphamin just because of it's a real peerless asset. I mean, it's the best mine in the world. It's just in a real rough part of town. And so it's got that big jurisdiction discount. And there's a question whether it will ever, you know, overcome that, especially since the news there it doesn't seem to be that good. But at the asset level, I mean, it's really hard to beat. And I think that, you know, what they'll do is, you know, pay dividends or, you know, maybe do a buyback or something to return that capital to shareholder in the event that the market never wants to re-rate it. Metals X is a little bit different, right? I mean, you've had a few guests talk about it on your show. There was some concern that, you know, they're sitting on a bunch of cash, like half the market cap, but will investors ever see that? Is there some, you know, misalignment of interest there? Governance issues that might prevent that capital return. I think they addressed it a little bit, you know, a month or so ago when they did that buyback, but the buyback was small. And so, I think it just highlights there's not a really perfect way to play the sector. I mean, you've got kind of everything's got issues with it. You know, I think today we may have Metals X maybe a little bit higher weighted in our commodity fund. You know, in our general funds, I think we own Alphamin just because it does have that kind of overall appeal. It's extremely low cost, so they can weather the volatility. But like I said, it changes given the different fluctuations in prices and outlook. But, you know, Metals X probably has the edge today just because of how much cash they have. It is a little bit cheaper, and you don't have really the jurisdiction risk to worry about. You know, Alphamin's cheap if you want to give it pro forma for the second mine that they're bringing on, which should be, you know, is basically imminent. And so, you know, I think you can kind of get close in valuation there. But the real question is how much do you want to avoid having any sort of jurisdiction risk? And so, I mean, we own both. I think it's a pretty easy sell given where they're valued and what our outlook is for the tin price and what that means for what these companies can earn.
JD, I reckon we need to amp up the GeoFids and the GeoChem and the friggin' assay compilation to get more tin and some Verify AI. I reckon that's the answer.
Mate,
if something that is scarce, that is how we're going to find it.
If I was an explorer looking for metals, tin would be very much on my radar. I've just heard what Brian's had to say about the supply-demand dynamics. And with Verify AI's new product coming in, they're going to help you find it. It's going to be that much cheaper, that much easier. It's a no-brainer.
Mate, Verify AI is the vehicle to take your company towards being a tin explorer, developer, producer. It is as easy as that, JD. Get on to them. Get Grant at give Grant at verify.com an email, no E in that Verify, and they will make it is a sophisticated onboarding process, training, everything. Like they map it out. They don't just hand it to you and expect you to use it. They map it out for you. They help you. They compile all the data. And, mate, they are a friggin' brilliant business. Get Verified, mining companies.
Should we chat about copper next, Matty?
Oh, mate, copper. Geez, I'd imagine that's another 2020 or previous play where you've been building the position there. Just a hunch.
Yeah, I mean, we've owned some copper for a while, just sort of as a generalist does. You know, I think we've owned Freeport for quite some time. More recently, over the last, call it, I guess, 3-4 years, we've started adding more copper. You know, we're really big fans of what the Lundins are doing down in South America. I think it's if you have the view that we're going to need a lot more copper and there haven't been a lot of discoveries, there haven't been a lot of exploration, all that sort of stuff, you know, it's only natural that we would be interested in something where it looks like it's one of the bigger discoveries of a generation here. And the fact that they have these people behind it with deep pockets and this expertise, operating expertise of, you know, decades, multiple generations of the family. It really is a good setup that we like in the space. And given how the price of copper was basically chopping around for the last few years, we didn't really want to just have pure play copper exposure. We wanted something where there was like a value creation lever. And, you know, I think, you know, we own Filo. That was a pretty good example in 2022 where, you know, I think the copper price was down 10-15% or something. And Filo was one of our best performing stocks. I think it nearly doubled that year. And so if you can have something that's not just a proxy on the copper price, that's a real good way to hide out kind of in a short-term environment where, you know, no one, like I said, no one wanted to own commodities, you know, in 2022 and 2023, up until really earlier this year. I mean, I think that's been the big shift on how we've been looking at copper is it looks like some of that demand concern that we saw over the last 2 years is starting to shift to supply concerns. You saw the price recently break out. I don't know what it's at now, maybe 450 or something. The fact that it's broken out of that range that it was in for so long, I think we're more willing to add companies that have that sort of, you know, pork to higher copper prices. You know, obviously you still want to have some sort of value creation levers at play, but, you know, you look at some of these copper producers and if the price goes from 4 to 5, I mean, their earnings are really going to go up a lot. And, you know, you look at some of the estimates of where copper has to go to really balance the market. You know, I think it wouldn't be out of the question to see $6 a pound or higher over the next few years. And if that's the case, then these things are, in our view, kind of dramatically misvalued. And so we're happy to really own a bunch of them that we think will benefit the most from that.
You speak about torque there, a word we are very fond of. And, you know, that plays into the price picking up and then there being a flight to trash, as you sort of put it before. Anecdotally, how do you see the popularity of metals and mining and commodity stocks broadly in the US at the moment?
It's not popular at all. That's one of the reasons we like it. You know, we do a lot of work with financial advisors and, you know, they, for the most part, they don't own any commodities, or their clients don't, or for their clients. Or if they do, it's like they own, you know, maybe some oil and gas ETF, right? You know, the big commodity ETFs are very oil and gas heavy. Maybe they own a little bit of copper or something, you know, like I said, some Freeport. But for the most part, you look at like the index weightings of mining and the S&P. I mean, the materials index is only about 2 or 3% of the S&P, and only a small fraction of that is actual mining companies. And so for the most part, people don't own it. And I don't think they feel like they have to own it because a lot of funds that people own really just track the index. And so everybody owns a lot of tech and mega cap and, you know, whatever AI stock is hot at the time. But, you know, I think commodities is not that popular. You're starting to see more interest in it. I think that's really what we like to see is that people realize that, you know, they read the news, they see what's going on. They see gold at an all-time high. They see people talking about copper, some of these other things, uranium. And say, hey, that's a really interesting, you know, what's the idea there? And so we do a lot of these calls privately where we talk about, you know, how this setup is, just like we've been talking about some of these other things. And I think, you know, investors are saying, hey, this is really interesting. It kind of used to be the thought that, oh, there aren't a lot of places to get growth in the market or earnings growth. I think that's why so many people have crowded into some of the tech names. But, you know, we lay out our view on why we think a lot of these mining companies are going to see pretty significant earnings growth over the coming years. You talked about, you know, the rising prices and how that feeds into earnings, especially on some of the higher cost guys, that margin expansion. I mean, we think these are going to be some of the better earnings growth stories over the coming years. And yet they're valued at some of the lowest valuations of any sector we see in the market. And I think maybe there's a number of reasons for that. But one of the big reasons is probably people didn't have to own them for a while. A lot of people don't like cyclicals. They don't like commodities. You know, it's hard enough to get the company right. Now try to get the commodity price right. And so you've just really seen almost avoidance of the sector. And it hasn't really mattered because people could throw a dart at the NASDAQ and you make your 20 or 30% a year. And so who cares, right? But when that starts to slip, and I think we saw a little bit of that in 2022 when, you know, a lot of the mega cap stuff crashed out. People, you know, it's a little bit of a wake up call, maybe not that much because the stocks obviously bounced back in 2023 and everyone just bought the dip. But you're starting to see it again, I think, even this year is, you know, the tech stocks really came out hot out of the gate. And then, you know, the last several weeks have been giving it back. And I think There's a big question amongst investors over how long you can continue to beat that horse of just riding tech stocks, you know, through thick and thin every year. There has been a lot of appetite for things that are differentiated where, hey, you can show this is a very compelling long-term return and it's completely uncorrelated from anything that you're doing. And so I think that's why, you know, the style of investing that we do has really resonated with a lot of investors because, you know, it does have that sort of return potential, but it's completely different from what other people have been using to get that sort of thing.
Yeah. How do you look at, in terms of the equities for copper, because copper is one of those commodities that has such a broad scale of capital required. You've got your small copper operations, you've got your massive porphyry operations that require billions of capex. Then you've got you've got the ones in the middle like your Sandfire and your metals acquisition that they're not a big porphyry. They're more your higher grade, but they don't require much capital. How do you look at which ones to get the most probably torque and most leverage to the copper price?
Yeah, well, so for, you know, the last few years, we were in development projects because I thought that was where a lot of the value creation was happening. I think now that the price is actually starting to rise, you can shift a little bit more towards near-term production, current producers, you know, guys that are going to see their earnings grow as a rising copper price flows through their income statement. You know, copper, yeah, there's a lot of names. I mean, it's especially in Australia traded there. You know, I think it's refreshing for us to be able to look at companies that actually have cash flow. I mean, I spent so many years looking at uranium companies where there was like one or two. It was all just analyzing and valuing development projects. I think tin, somewhat similar. I mean, there are really only a handful of producers that you can model out. So it's nice to come to something like copper and say, oh, hey, there's, you know, dozens of producing companies. Where do you want to spend your time? Like I said, I mean, development stage was really where we hit out, for lack of a better word, for the last few years. Now that we're seeing some of these, the price start to actually move and people focus on these supply concerns. Yeah, we like producers, guys that can take that rising price and turn it into near-term cash flow. And then if you have some extra levers that you can pull, whether it's, you know, bringing on a new mine or something like that, where you're going to get some additional, you know, earnings growth that maybe is not being, you know, properly valued by the market, then that's all the better. But really, I think where we've shifted and what our portfolios are probably seeing more of today are some of these producers that are actually going to see a, you know, near-term boost to earnings. And we think that they're trading pretty cheaply because I don't think a lot of people are expecting that. Now, I will say recently, you know, give it the last maybe few months, a lot of people have been jumping on the copper bandwagon. You've seen a number of the big banks come out with reports talking about, you know, price got to go to $5, $6, $7 higher. And so it's not necessarily anything secret. You know, I think the valuations have started to improve. I mean, a lot of these copper companies are up 30, 40, 50% over the last 6 months. So it has been good timing for us. I think it probably continues that, you know, these things aren't a straight line. You know, you may see some pullback from time to time, but we're not really trying to estimate what the daily move is or even the monthly move. You know, we're looking at longer term supply and demand, thinking where do prices have to go over the next few years? And if the prices get there, what does that imply for what these companies can earn and how are they valued relative to that earnings power? And we think a lot of these things are very cheap because like some of these other commodities, I think supply is going to have a very tough time meeting the demand that's out there, which is just going to continue to put upward pressure on prices until people start to develop more supply. And the people that can either bring on that supply at a low cost or are currently producing are going to benefit from that. And so, yeah, it's a big part of our portfolio today.
Oh, just one more on that, JD. Your big porphyries, like the ones in the Vicuña, Casa Bell, Wafi Golpu, all those sort of ones, would you class them as the most riskiest ones to, I know Wafi's inside Newmont, but one, in terms of risky to invest in just because of the amount of capital required and the risk of it being developed or not based on getting that capital?
I think anytime you have an earlier stage project, there's more of those risks. A lot of times it's those big projects, like you mentioned, that, you know, maybe it's worth taking those risks because there's a lot of value there. I mean, I'll give you an example. I think our biggest copper position right now, I think, is Filo, which is one of those giant development projects. It's going to be billions of dollars to develop. In fact, we just had the CEO was in our office last week. And so we were asking him all these questions. You know, it's, they have all these just incredible drill results that come out. I mean, I think they just put one out yesterday. This thing's huge. I mean, it's going to be a huge hole in the ground that they're going to develop at some point in time. You know, they haven't put out a resource yet just because they continue to find mineralization. They haven't really found the edge of this thing. And so it's been this kind of back and forth. I mean, you know, we were telling them, hey, you know, it's great. I mean, we love to see all these drill results, but I think you're not really getting the bang for the buck that you used to when you were putting these things out a few years ago. I think there's a lot more interest now. People already agree, hey, you've got a massive resource. How's it going to be developed? Who's it going to develop it? How are all the pieces going to be put in place? You know, they have those other related entities that are around them and different projects in different stages. So yeah, to partially answer your question, our biggest position is one of those big type of deposits. But lately we've been adding a lot more of just, you know, current producers, because we think that if the price rises from here and continues and goes up to $5 or higher, you're going to see more kind of tangible value creation from the guys that can capture that and turn it into cash flow. Whereas, you know, a rising copper price for some of these development projects is more of like a modeling exercise of, you know, how much should this be worth? And you can look at, you know, comps or other resource companies at similar stages, or you can actually kind of, you know, pencil out a mine plan and think of what they're going to build. I think that's one of the reasons that there is a push for them to release at least an initial resource estimate later this year, is people want to start doing those numbers and really highlighting the value that's been created. I think it's a lot tougher for people to get their mind around when it's still at the early stage, especially sort of traditional investors, which is where, you know, a lot of new capital needs to come from. You know, it's funny, we consider ourselves value, almost deep value looking at this stuff, but people look at our portfolios and they'll say, you know, like, what's your PE ratio or something? We'll say, well, you know, half of our companies don't even have revenue. I mean, let alone earnings, right? The earnings are negative. And so, you know, we have to do different sort of valuation methodologies depending on what stage the company's in. That's a good example of it. And when you get these things where incremental, you know, additions of resource from the drill bit aren't really moving the needle anymore, then I think investors want to see some, you know, more on the corporate development front. They want you to put a marker in the ground. Look, the trade-off for that company was always, hey, we don't want to release a resource estimate too soon because we're still finding stuff. And if we're going to give a number to the market, let's give it the biggest number we can find. I think now, though, they just have so much. The additional hits that they're getting, you know, I mean, people are like, okay, we get it. You've got a lot of resource. Let's just kind of put a box around it so people can start to value without having to just really do back of the envelope type stuff. And so, you know, it's encouraging to see that progressing, you know, and we have a few other companies that are in that stage. But I think today, if we're in an environment where the price is, hey, you know, now we're going to get that re-rating, or at least a start of it, to, you know, call it north of $5 if it keeps going. Probably the most immediate beneficiaries are going to be the producers that are going to see that increase in cash flow. And then the real question is, you know, how are these things being valued based on that? You know, and can we kind of buy a handful of these things that we think will be the biggest beneficiaries?
I'd hate to see a PE ratio of my portfolio as well, Brian. It'd be pretty gruesome.
One thing that's not spoken about in terms of copper demand is the amount of power that Silverstone supplies. So power needs copper wire, JD. With the growth of Silverstone in this power generation and supply industry, this is going to be a big driver of the copper market.
And imagine you're building this Vicuña district. You're building this very complicated project, and you think, gee, I just think somebody could take a bit of this weight off my shoulders. If someone could just sort out everything power-related for me, I wish there was someone that can do that. You're telling me there is?
There is, mate. Silverstone, mate, they are power. Boom.
Power.
Simple as that. So, mate, if you need to power, mate, if you want to power the Vicuña, you want to power any mine site of any scale, Silverstone have a solution, whether it's a green form, old school diesel jennies, they tick all the boxes for PowerJD, get them on site, Silverstone. She's a one-stop, vertically integrated shop for mining.
Mate, they're right here in WA. They've done it with some of the biggest miners in the country. They've got their reputation. Go and have a chat with them. They will look after you.
Silverstone, thanks for driving the copper price up.
To tie out the last commodity I want to speak about is gold, and I want to come at it from a macro-type lens to start with. You spoke about in your recent quarterly letter about a few different ratios you look at, you know, the Buffett indicator comparing the US stock market and US GDP. Another sort of metric that's been kicked around a lot is the US debt to the nation's GDP. And tying that in, we've seen what appears to be a lot of central bank buying in gold in, you know, for over a year now, but in particular, the last few months have been quite lofty. I noticed the 13Fs you referred to before, that Agnico and Barrick, I think I saw, were some of your US holdings in gold. What's the thesis with gold? Some people come at it from a real value lens, others from a, you know, government debt type lens. How do you view it?
Yeah, gold has been a tough one, especially on the mining side, just because they've struggled on their operations. You know, production has been declining for the most part and costs have been rising. And so, you know, even though the price of gold is hitting all-time highs, a lot of these guys are seeing lower margins than they did, you know, a few years ago when gold price was much lower. And so, you know, I've always struggled with gold just because it's difficult to handicap the demand because so much of it is dependent on those things you just mentioned. You know, what are central banks doing? What is investor sentiment? You know, are guys, you know, gold bugs going to the coin store and, you know, loading up on bullion? That sort of stuff is really hard to quantify. And so I've always preferred the industrial metals where it get, you know, the demand gets consumed. And so it not isn't just being moved from kind of one vault to another. I think that's why in the precious metal space, we've tended a little bit more towards silver. I mean, we talked about Adriatic a little bit in the past, which is one of the ones we own. And, you know, I guess silver is their largest component. They also have some gold, but we like, I guess if I'm going to be forced to own gold, I kind of like byproduct gold because I want to have the driver being something that I can really understand the supply demand better. But yeah, we've owned gold miners for years, for better or worse. You know, I think that it remains to be seen if they can keep their costs under control, because you don't get any benefit of a rising price if your costs are rising faster than it. In fact, it hurts you. And I think that's one of the reasons that you've seen the stocks do so poorly. Yeah, you know, we own a couple of those big ones in kind of our more diversified funds. We own, I mean, you know, the problem with the 13Fs is you don't see a lot of our international, you don't see any of our international stocks. They're the ones that are traded in Canada or Australia because we're not required to file them. But that's actually where we've done the best on the gold side are some of the more intermediate producers or developers that have had kind of that value creation lever that I've talked about in the past. Like we own Agnico because we own Kirkland Lake, and we did very well on Kirkland Lake. And that was one where, you know, they had the grades and they kept finding stuff. And it was, you know, not just a proxy for the gold price and an imperfect proxy at that, where you got, you know, the gold price going up and their earnings going down. So, you know, I think we have it in our portfolio. There is a chance that some of these gold producers kind of get past their operational challenges. They can keep their costs in control. And especially if you get an environment where, you know, the gold price keeps rising at a pretty fast clip, like it's done in the last few months, there's a chance that, you know, that heals all wounds there. And the price goes up so fast that even their missteps, you know, get overlooked. But, you know, we're happy to own a little bit for that sort of eventuality. But I think where the bulk of our portfolio is positioned is on some of these more kind of special situation type of commodity plays where you have these big supply demand imbalances and you need the price to rise in order to fix them. And so, you know, that was uranium for us, still is, but that in a big way the last several years. And more recently, we've started adding some of these other ones. You know, I would argue that both tin and copper, the price is too low to really bring on enough new supply to balance those markets. And so you've started to see those prices move in the last few months. I think we'll continue to see that, you know, sort of daily volatility notwithstanding. Like I said, we don't really care about the daily swings in these things. I think we have a view that marginal cost is going to drive where these prices eventually shake out. A lot of times you'll see it overshoot that just because nothing really moves in a straight line. But if we can find something where we think that the price has to rise because the market's out of balance, and we can find ways to express that view that are kind of cheaply valued on an absolute basis, that's a great combination there. And it's been, I guess we're not the only ones that are interested in that. We've been doing a lot of calls lately just because I think there are other people out there that are interested in that sort of idea for generating returns. They realize it's got a long runway. I mean, I think these sorts of supply-demand imbalances play out over a multi-year period. And so, it's great for us to kind of identify them, do the work, build the positions, and then really let them play out over a long time frame.
On Adriatic there, Brian, obviously a lot has changed since you would have picked up that position, and they're really coming into being a producer, and they've been rewarded for that pretty strongly. How do you see the balance at the moment? Have you started selling some of your position? Are you still holding on?
We've held a pretty stable core position there for several years now. I think the question is what prices do you expect them to achieve? This year they're going to ramp up the mine. So what we really want to see there is, how does the production shake out? What do the costs look like? Is this thing going to work? Are they going to run into challenges? And so I think the next few quarters, it's really going to be sort of a show me story. Like, okay, you've turned it on. For the longest time, no one really cared about it. It kind of languished there. I think, and people said, hey, let's see what happens when the mine comes on. There were a few delays. And so whenever you get into that sort of situation, I think people want to see the cash flow hit you. But, they put out some guidance a few weeks ago. And if they can hit that, you kind of run a current price deck or whatever price you want to see. And it looks like it's pretty cheap, given what they're going to produce all these different commodities for a fairly low cost, because it's a polymetallic mine. So, we haven't really dialed it up or down too much. We've just kind of held this core position. And I think what we're really looking for is, how does the ramp up progress, and what sort of prices are they able to achieve here? Because, like I said, given our view of where a lot of the prices of the products that they produce are going, I mean, I think it trades. It's a very cheap way to get exposure to that. I guess the joke there is, they're going to produce a lot of silver. Silver stocks usually get a pretty high premium, and so, should they change their name to Adriatic Silver because maybe they'll get a valuation uplift? I think the big wild card there is that, if I can maybe draw a parallel to MetalsX, is MetalsX already has the cash. And the question was, what are they going to do with it? Are they going to give it back? They did some sort of questionable transactions, buying some other equities. They talked about wanting to do M&A. That's tough to handicap, right? If they go out and do some big splashy acquisition, you don't know ahead of time how to really, if you want that or not. I think that's been the case also with Adriatic. Their CEO has kind of been on record saying they'd like to duplicate this process that they've done, which is identify a mine and bring it into production. And we'll see what happens. I mean, in that case, because you don't know what that target is going to be, you're really relying more heavily on the management to identify those things, and hopefully they can find something similarly attractive. But I think for us, that's kind of the big things that we're watching there is, how does the mine ramp up go? And then once this thing starts generating cash, what do they do with it?
Beautiful.
Bloody lovely, mate. Brilliant yarn. We could go for another hour, but I've got to go sort the kids out, unfortunately, today. But
it's past 5 o'clock where you are in the world there in LA, so we will let you enjoy your evening. But appreciate you making the time, Brian. It was great to talk about all things commodities.
Everything we're interested in.
Like I said, I'm a big fan of the show. Thank you guys for having me on. Like I said, we get a lot of these invites. Don't do a lot of them just because not a lot of the stuff we do changes very frequently. But every maybe once or twice a year we'll come on, and you guys are one of the few people talking about tin, so I was always happy.
Well, mate, we're very flattered that someone at your level is listening to us, so we really appreciate it, mate.
Yeah, look forward to circling back in a year or half a year's time on all these commodities.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Oh, geez, that was a ripper, JD. I love talking about shit I like talking about. That's the best way to put it.
Don't we all? A bit of copper, a bit of tin, a bit of uranium. I love it. And all these, you know, people in different necks of the woods, different views. They've got different theses. They're holding different stocks. It's fascinating to help round out our thesis and, you know, make us smarter, Matty.
Mate, but tell you what, I still don't know how the fuck you find all these people, JD. You're all over it. If it was up to me, I'd be just talking to you and Trav every day. So, mate, top job. But I just love hearing about how early a lot of these funds are placed in these. Like, you know, we've only been going for a year, but these funds have been looking at these thematics in like 2018 and things like that, and really getting in early and going through shit times and not making anything.
Yeah, and I really love these value-oriented guys who came into it when it was a contrarian, beaten-up space.
Yeah.
You know, like uranium, for example, 5-odd years ago. These people that like to invest in the Munger, the Buffett sort of style, really appeals to me, and you know, I think it makes for a great chat that we can all learn a bit off.
I like just investing and making it this year. So we'll see how we go. Righto, thanks to Brian for coming on. Thanks to all the partners. We talked about Verify and Silverstone during the episode. We've also got Get Wet Solutions, DSI Underground, Anytime Exploration, WA Waterbores, Brooks Airways, and
K-Drill.
Utero Money Miners.
Utero.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.